This is now the eighth issue of our quarterly journal, Sapir. And for those of you who doubt it, I'm holding our gorgeously produced print copy in our hand with a hand-drawn cover. Each issue of Sapir is devoted to a single topic. So we began with social justice. We talked about power, continuity, aspiration, Zionism, education, cancellation. And when we decided to devote an entire issue to culture, we wanted, I think, a somewhat more upbeat approach to Jewish subjects. So you and I managed to write the only two truly depressing essays in an otherwise very optimistic issue. But you wrote really, I think, an extraordinary essay, very profound and a very troubling one, the title of which is A Swinging Bunch of People No Longer. So let's begin with that phrase, a swinging bunch of people. To some people on this call who haven't read this, who are the swinging bunch of people, and who said that?
So Sammy Davis Jr. converted to Judaism in 1961. And he followed in the footsteps of Marilyn Monroe, who had converted in 1956, and Elizabeth Taylor, who had converted in 1957. Taylor to marry Michael Todd, who then died a year later. Monroe converted, she was married to Arthur Miller, but Arthur Miller, the playwright, was a crypto communist and had very little interest in had very little interest in Judaism as a topic, but she felt connected. And then Sammy Davis Jr. converted. These conversions were a mark of the astonishing position that American Jewry had moved into by the late 1950s, early 1960s. And Sammy Davis Jr. asked why he became a Jew. One of the things he said was, well, they're a swinging bunch of people. What did he mean by that? He meant that at the time, really in the years post-dating the Second World War, Jewry in the United States had moved into a prime cultural position. Jews were among the hottest novelists, poets, painters, cultural figures of the day, and they had become hip and chic and fashion forward in a way that would have been unimaginable to their, you know, was even unimaginable at the time to people who were a generation older, Jews and non-Jews alike, a generation earlier.
And to what extent was that independent of or connected to the Second World War and the Holocaust?
Well, it was connected, I'm sure, because of the overwhelming degree of sympathy that Americans and the world at the time felt toward the Jewish people as a result of the Shoah and the sense that something uniquely evil in history had happened to this people, and there was this remnant left in the United States who were deserving of a new kind of sympathy, let's say. So if you begin from the sympathy, that played a serious role in making people more open to discovering what Jews were like and what interested them and what was special and interesting about them. In the piece, I point out that there was spade work had been done in the course of the 20th century before the Second World War, in which Jews, for complicated reasons, had become major figures in the world of mass entertainment as mass entertainment was on the rise.
Right.
Movies, radio, in particular, that in classic fashion, Jews denied access, ambitious American Jews and immigrants denied access to the high water, the high places, both of culture and of business, universities, professorships, or law firms, stock brokerages, things like that, had to make do by making their mark in industries that would allow them in. And there was this totally new industry that was entertainment.
Right.
And so they moved into positions in entertainment as it was building, sort of like, you know, Silicon Valley was the Silicon Valley of its day. And so a lot of figures in this world, particularly in the world of radio, were immigrant Jews, were, you know, sort of, and in movies, movie studio executives who had, were immigrants, Sam Goldwyn from London, Carl Laemmle from Germany, various other figures, and David Sarnoff, who started RCA, who was a...
By capturing the drama of the Titanic in real time.
Yeah, he was a telegraph, was a Western Union telegraph agent who was receiving the telegrams from and basically started communicating them outward. And then he had this vision that this was actually a new way of communicating mass information. Anyway, so these guys then were sort of big figures. Jewish creators, Irving Berlin, other people became big cultural figures. And a key moment, totally forgotten, is that one of the first successful radio programs in the United States, nationally broadcast, was a daily soap opera sitcom about a Jewish family in the Bronx called The Goldbergs. Interestingly, like there's a TV show now called The Goldbergs, which has no connection. Made by a woman named Gertrude Berg, who was the writer and the star. And it was on air daily on NBC for more than two decades and served for Jews a little bit what the Cosby Show did for Jews, a little bit what the Cosby Show did for upper middle class African Americans, let's say, or middle. It was like it presented a positive, glowing,
right,
touching image of day-to-day quotidian life among American Jews, and basically soften the ground in the, you know, for this more positive idea of what Jews were like. And so by the time Sammy Davis Jr. converts in 1961, not only are Jews popular, not only is there, you know, are there the Jewish writers, like the most important writers in America, Bellow, Malamud, Roth, all kinds of other
figures. Herman Woke.
Herman Woke, previous decades, even before that, Sholem Ash, I.J. Singer, who was Israel Bashev, who was Isaac Bashevis' singer's brother, and was actually a best-selling novelist in the 30s and 40s. Anyway, so they were there, but when you look at like the hippest people in the 1950s and 1960s, who would say be the version of like hip hop superstars in the 2000s and 2010s, Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., others, their entire performing and vocal style was borrowed not from the Italian that, you know, Sinatra was an Italian from Hoboken, New Jersey, but from Yiddish. They sounded, if you listen to them, they sound like they are Borscht Belt comedians. And they took in this life, accent, spirit, also Jewish comedians, I haven't even mentioned those. And so they were just at the epicenter of American life, and these celebrities wanted to become Jews, in part because they thought Jews, there was something hip and forward and optimistic, and like this was the people you wanted to be a part of.
So they were, I mean, there's a kind of, what you're describing is a sort of a 20-year parenthesis in Jewish history when we were sufficiently outsiders to be cool, right? But at the same time, the ground had been broken by an earlier, the previous generation. So we were also sufficiently successful to be someone's idea of an aspiration, right? That was that. That seems to be right. The formula that you're describing,
right?
And that today,
and particularly if we take Marilyn Monroe and Sammy Davis Jr., though I don't really reflect on this in the piece, Marilyn Monroe, hard scrabble childhood, daughter of a schizophrenic, sort of like barely had food as a kid, and Sammy Davis Jr., obviously Afro-Cuban, African-American, like basically danced for his supper from the age of 3 or 4 as a being a performer with his dad's the trio, the Will Maston trio, singing, dancing, all of that. And nonetheless facing absolutely horrendous and horrific racism when he went into the army after World War II, and feeling oppressed and feeling like the Jews were the ultimate oppressed peoples, and he felt oppressed, and yet Jews seem to have this path out of their oppression. Marilyn Monroe said, I always liked Jews because I felt like they had been, hard done like I was. And Sammy Davis Jr. kind of said the same thing. But I mean, just imagine this today. Can you imagine people sort of like converting? I mean, people now convert to Judaism every day in some ways, but it was a very startling thing to join this, oppressed minority group at the time, still with 14 to 16% quotas on their admission to Ivy League universities. So they were still, they were hot. They were still, though, marginal. Yeah. Not, they weren't marginal, but they were off to the side of conventional mainstream American professional life.
So
that all broke down. Yeah.
And so let's fast forward. So what happened between in the 60s and 70s is all the barriers to success, the informal ones, the gentlemen's agreements, the country clubs that excluded Jews, all of that went away. Jews became essentially paragons of the new American establishment. And at the same time, you had the rise of, and you as editor commentary have been writing about this for a long time, a new creeping anti-Semitism, much of it actually coming from parts of Black America that used to be much more closely allied to it, and culminating, I think, if it is a culmination, in Kanye West's DEFCON 3 on Jewish people. And you wrote something that I thought was really fascinating and important. So I want to read it and just get you to expand on it. You write, Sammy Davis Jr. was attracted to Judaism. West has been seduced by the oldest and most enduring hatred on earth. Why? For one thing, West may be mentally ill, while Davis most definitely was not. But West, this is the important part, West is also fashion forward as Davis was, and fashion forward people have some sort of internal barometer that keeps them from going outside a boundary they cannot cross back from. That barometer helped guide West to the conclusion that he would not be in danger of seeming culturally off by expressing vile sentiments about Jewish doctors, among others. He might lose endorsements and become a font of scandal, but he would not be uncool. Now, is that, you wrote this a couple months ago when it was relatively hot, the story. Do you think that's still true, or has West really been, in a sense, truly, well and truly defenestrated and a line drawn? How do you feel about that?
I don't think he's been defenestrated at all. I mean, we have no markers to judge this except for the fact he lost his endorsements. But he hasn't dropped new music. He hasn't introduced a new product into the marketplace by himself. You would need evidence like that to help you judge whether or not he had sort of gone so far beyond the pale that people were uncomfortable with him. But I really, really doubt that's the case. And I'll give you the example that helps support my point. Kyrie Irving, the New Jersey Nets player, who followed along Kanye West by talking about, I'm sorry, my dog is barking in the background. I don't know if you can hear that. Kanye West, Kyrie Irving just sort of started raising questions about the Holocaust and that sort of, you know, he was just raising questions, promoting a film that, you know, that questioned the number of deaths in the Holocaust. Got into big trouble in New York. The New Jersey Nets, you know, made him apologize. There were then counter demonstrations supporting him in Brooklyn. The Nets have traded him, or he has asked for a trade. They've now traded him. But another team wanted him. Other teams want him. His career in the NBA is not at all compromised by what he did. He apologized or said he was sorry if he made anybody feel bad. And then upon being traded, he deleted his apology from Instagram. He had issued an Instagram apology, and then the apology is now gone. I bring this up only to say that Kyrie Irving didn't see the need to keep his apology up once his future had been secured with a trade to a new team. And Kanye West, you know, Whoopi Goldberg continues every couple of months to say something very untoward, doesn't get fired from The View on ABC, and that kind of thing. So it's very complicated. And I mean, I don't think people are not, you know, my chances are if you were to go to Spotify and measure the streams of Kanye West today versus the streams in September, I doubt they would be much different.
So what is, clearly there are a number of drivers to this. One is that, I mean, anti-Semitism, when it comes from right-wing white America, is clearly still considered absolutely verboten. It's beyond the pale. It's universally condemned. It's not condemned when it's coming from other sides of the racial or ideological divides. That's to say that particularly, you know, with Kanye and Irving, Louis Farrakhan still inhabits a certain kind of, it's not exactly a place of honor, but he's a figure, right? More than anything else. Al Sharpton has a show on MSNBC, and the incidents of the, he's kind of tried to quasi make amends, but he's still there. It's also coming from the fact that anti-Zionism has now become a fashion forward type of belief. So talk a little bit about that, about this blending of absolutely acceptable, if anything, cool anti-Zionism and what we're witnessing with respect to more traditional anti-Semitic tropes.
So in 2011 or 2013, I can't remember which year, when the Pew Charitable Trust did its massive study of Jewish life in America, and the enshrined forever the clear sense that 50% of Jews were intermarrying, that conservative Jewry was becoming a historical anachronism and would probably basically be demographically gone in two generations, and that Jews felt mild connection to their Judaism in the form of food and things like that, but weren't really practicing in America and weren't professing. There was the sense that what had happened to American Jewry in the course of the century was a genuinely catastrophic triumph. Jews had become fully American in exactly the way that Jews had never been American, had never been a citizen of any other country ever on the face of this earth, and that they had sucked deep from the pleasures of assimilation and the pleasures of complete acceptance or almost complete acceptance, and that they had, therefore, they were beginning to lose their distinct identities and their distinct separateness. And I thought this is a very, the reason I go with this back, answer your question backwards, is that the catastrophic success is precisely that Jews have no barrier to success in the United States. Quite the opposite in some ways. Like I make mention in the piece of the fact that in 1960, Jews were aghast and horrified, and through several decades after, at systems, you know, that denied them access to Ivy League schools, these quotas. 60 years later, Asian Americans complain of the same problem. You will note that Jews are very much not participants in the effort to fight the Ivies on their noxious handling of Asian American applicants, because for three generations now, Jews have become the very people, part of the very people who benefit from the current system of legacy and donor and alumni support that gives them special access to Ivy League institutions. They, like the people who want to put the quotas on in the first place, their children and their grandchildren or great-grandchildren are now part of the system. So Jews run companies all over the country. They are law firms all over the place. They do well. They're the second most affluent ethnic group in the United States.
After and
Nigerians, I think Nigerians are now the most affluent Americans as a subgroup, but they are so that they're now, you know, in the mix of American life in a totally normal way, in a way that has actually, you know, frayed their connection to their own separateness and particularism, and that makes them a target for people who think that conventional American life as a whole is, you know, is bad and unfair and unjust and intersectionally hostile. And then you then layer on the fact that, you know what, in the end, Jews really aren't necessarily totally accepted and do make up 2% of the population of the United States and are part of a faith tradition that rejects the cosmology or the, you know, the eschatology of the main religion in the United States, which is Christianity, and is basically in part defined by not being Christian and by not believing in the divinity of Christ. And as people say, well, what is this with these Jews? They're being 2% of the population. Here they are, like, doing, you know,
right,
doing so well. And then there is some, then the old stuff starts flooding back. Something unfair. They're a cabal. They're up to no good. They're mixing together and they're doing things like, when you see the truth about them, this was, you know, Kanye West, their doctors, you know, throw you into an insane asylum and medicate you, say you're a schizophrenic, but you know the truth, and they're just using their power to poison you and kill you, which is,
I want to just
answer your question, or did I just, like, go?
Well, it starts to answer. I mean, essentially, we have adopted a set of cultural frameworks in the United States, all of which are unique. They're not directly aimed at Jews, but when you think about them, they're uniquely invidious for Jews, because when, you know, it used to be that Americans celebrated success, today we condemn privilege, which is just two sides of the same coin. But if you condemn privilege, then, as you noted, it's easy to then note the fact that the Jews are a privileged class, not a successful class, but privileged. If you condemn intellectual heterodoxy, for instance, which is another kind of runs in Jewish DNA, so to speak, right? Then, and all of a sudden, thinking different means being a bad person, That's a problem for Jews. When you racialize every issue in the United States so that there are only white people and people of color, then Jews suddenly find themselves shunted into this category of whiteness to which we never previously belonged. So right. All of these tropes, which sort of emerge kind of separately from Jewish questions, become kind of deeply problematic for us, because at the end, the target they find is disproportionately Jewish. I just want to say quickly to the people who are listening in, within about 10 or 15 minutes, we're going to go to questions from you. So at the bottom of your Zoom page, you will see a Q&A function. And as John provokes thoughts and provocations and ideas, whatever, put those questions in the Q&A box, and we will move to them as soon as we can. I want to start thinking a little bit about the solution side to this conversation, because, you know, one real possibility, and this has been raised by a number of thoughtful friends of mine, is we're just kind of sliding back toward a mean. It doesn't mean we're heading for the Holocaust, but it means that we're going back to a kind of older version of America where everyday anti-Semitism was a commonplace of life, where there was where Jews were a little more ghettoized in the culture, where they no longer sort of stood at the pinnacles of the American literary or journalistic establishment, and where their basic strategy was tone it down, kind of on the English model, and live your life and keep your head down. It may be the case that that's what we're heading towards. But is there a way to maintain that kind of combination of our affirmation of differences, our ebullience and our distinctiveness, as well as our success in the United States? What should Jews be doing now? You hinted at some of this in your essay. So elaborate on it.
So the catastrophic success that I mentioned earlier, you know, measured by the Pew poll, dates back to this very idea, which is that from time immemorial, and particularly in the United States, there was this idea that if Jews pushed themselves too far, too forward, made too many demands on the culture, that there would be terrible blowback. You know, it's one of my favorite Jewish jokes is the two Jews are in front of a firing squad, and the guy at the head of the firing squad says, "Any last requests?" And one guy says, "I would like, please, a blindfold." And the other one says, "Sam, don't make trouble." Like, Sam, don't make trouble is do whatever you want, go as far as you want, don't make trouble. Trouble is going to come back to you double. And that really hasn't been a problem for American Jewry for a very, very long time. I mean, there are these moments when you can say there were more than 100 years ago, the lynching of Leo Frank in Atlanta. Like, there are moments where you could see the sort of the culture pop up and say, you've gone too far, we're gonna put you in your place because you're getting too uppity. But that I'm, you know, almost 62 years old, that has really not been a feature of my life in my lifetime. But when Jews are attacked on the streets of Brooklyn for wearing kippot, you know, when people come out of nowhere and then sucker punch somebody in the back of the head because he is visually, you know, he is wearing the garb of a believing Jew, that's new. Like, that's new in our lives, or that's new in my lifetime, pretty much. Not that Jews didn't have, you know, street fights and things like that. This is a new thing. And
well, what's really also the case is that it's going totally unpunished.
Well, And the fact that it's going totally unpunished, of course, makes it more, then you get to the point where it's like, it's fine. Okay, you know, like you can do it. You don't have any consequences from it. That spurs more attacks. So my view is that Jews have secured positions of authority and power, and that when there is a crisis and you need to defend yourself, you don't, that's what it's for. You keep it in reserve until you really need it. And that the last thing Jews need to do is to go hide or beg as people do, beg for mercy. That is to say, Jews say, we're going to show you that you shouldn't be mean to us. Come to Yad Vashem. We'll fly you to Israel. You'll see that 6 million of us died, and you'll feel sorry for us. And then maybe you won't think that we're so bad, and you'll stop being mean to us. That is a horrible model. It's a nightmarishly bad model for people who are acting in bad faith or even criminally. And the question is, what do you do if you're a community that has great resources, great access, and things like that? And I would say that the answer is to stop apologizing and start threatening. I mean, and I don't mean threatening like going into a dark back room and saying, you know, we're gonna, you know, the media is, we control the media and the banks, and we're gonna deny you loans and attack you in the press. I mean, you go to politicians and say, we're gonna raise $100 million and we're gonna get you voted out of office unless you say you're gonna do something about X, Y, or Z. Or you, and part of my brief here is that Jewish fraternal organizations and Jewish self-defense organizations, such as they are, have become woefully inadequate and even damaging to this specific cause, because they
are relying on the "you should be pitying us, not hating us" model.
That, and also they believe, for complicated reasons having to do with what it's like to work in these fields, you know, that their access to the people who are being mean to us is very important to them. We need to keep the doors, we need to keep the lines of communication open and have wonderful, you know, ecumenical meetings at which we all talk about our problems with each other. And that's really very important, and that we need to express solidarity with them, show them that they will be helpful to them. And then maybe again, they will leave us alone. This is an absolutely dreadful model, because there are times when it is better to be feared than loved, and it is better to be feared than loved when your people are under assault. And this gets to the final point about the catastrophic success. Now we're going far afield from my essay, or sort of.
Always nice to have Machiavelli right in the mix here.
Yes, yeah, famous proto-Jew Niccolo Machiavelli. The idea has to be that Jews have to stop feeling as though they need to show nice other minority groups that they are nice and progressive. I don't mean this because I'm an anti-progressive. I am, but it doesn't matter. They have to also feel solidarity and communal solidarity with the Jews who are publicly Jewish, with Hasidim and Haredim who are getting attacked in Brooklyn and places like that, which they don't. And I will get, you know, they don't feel that. They feel very much as though, you know, they're very hostile to them often. And the problem is that they are, as Jews are for the rest of the world, religious Jews are the canary in the coal mine for secular Jews.
Right.
And if you don't stop what's going on at the root, or you don't like pull it out by the root, that's why I'm saying 25 years from now, this weird combination of the privilege argument that you mentioned, that we're just privileged people and we're unjustly taking fruits of our privilege, And you combine that with old ideas about Jews and anti-Semitism reflected in Kyrie Irving and Kanye West and Ilhan Omar and, you know, Ayanna Pressley and others, and you, those bubble out like that, and then other people are going to start getting punched in the streets too and shot. And it's not just going to be, you know, lunatic right wingers who go shoot up synagogues.
One thing you said, just before we go to the questions from our audience, you talked about how Jews should move away from the model of the nonprofit organizations that have been the traditional advocacy groups for Jews. And you said Jews should go subject by subject, building coalitions of interest based on specific issues rather than the nebulous whole of quote unquote fighting anti-Semitism. What do you have in mind with from the
okay, that? What I mean by that is don't give your $1 million because you're upset about, you know, if you're the sort of person who is upset about attacks in Brooklyn, don't give your $1 million to the Anti-Defamation League. Start a group that is called Jews Against Attacks on Jews in Brooklyn. Raise money that way. And your point is you're focusing on a very specific issue. And then you go to politicians and people in power and you say, what are you doing about this? I'm not talking about anything else. I don't want to talk about housing. I don't want to talk about, you know, intersectionality. I don't want to talk about education. I'm here to talk about what you are going to do. What patrols are you going to put on the street? How are you going to do this? Successful Jewish efforts over the last 10 years to combat very specific threats have been successful. There is a communal effort to deal with security problems at synagogues being run by, again, sort of new coalitions. I mean, some of them are sort of partially out of the United Jewish Appeal, but these are new efforts and they're very specific and singular. And similarly, you know, so that's what I would say. That's my model is, you know, when people decided to go at BDS on campuses, they went after BDS. They didn't have an umbrella. They weren't doing 25 other things. They got together to fight BDS, different groups and different people raised money to fight BDS. And they went campus by campus. They supported Jewish kids on campus who were fighting efforts to, you know, hurt them and defund them and do all that. And those efforts, specific issue-based efforts, at where risks and threats to Jews and Jewry and Zionism and all that come up, those are really successful. Going into one of these, you know, things where you give the ADL $1 million and they spend $750,000 of it on DEI programs, congratulations, you have just wasted your money and actually possibly made it worse, not better.
We're going to take this to our audience. I'm going to ask questions, not in any particular order, but as they catch my eye. Let's see. Lawrence Greenberg has an interesting question. How do non-Orthodox Jews contribute to the vilification of Jews by cravingly justifying how liberal and white bread Americans we have become? If we do not exhibit and assert Jewish pride along the lines of 1960s Black liberation movements, we non-Israeli Jews will be rump atavistic people as predicted by Toynbee. Thoughts?
I agree with the approach, and I agree with the sentiment that the larger way to say this that is less provocative than that, not that I'm a believer in being less provocative, is you can't sue for peace with people who don't want peace. So stop suing for peace. You know, don't, again, like using his out, don't go to Al Sharpton looking for peace. He wants war. So you don't have to give him war. You do give him war whenever you want to give him war, but you don't go and seek comedy with people who are attacking you and making your people unsafe. And there is a classic human temptation under these circumstances to blame the victim, right? I mean, like if you grew up in New York like I did when it was like high crime and somebody came to you and said, I just got mugged, you know, it would be like, well, what did you do? Were you walking? Did you, you know, were you paying attention? Like, you know, someone gets there. There's often this idea that you want to say it's your fault. It's your fault for being so provocative. And a lot of liberal Jews feel that way. They feel like you harried him. You're mean to your wives, and you're not educating your children properly. And I don't want to be associated with you. Well, tough shit. Because you are, and that's what I'm saying. You don't want to be associated with them now. 20 years from now, you'll be huddled behind your gated communities, terrified to go out in the streets or go to synagogue on Yom Kippur, should you want to go to synagogue on Yom Kippur, because you're worried that someone is going to firebomb your shul.
Here's another question. Eric Lipman asks, as Kyrie Irving was traded to the Dallas Mavericks, owned by a Jew, Mark Cuban, is there a sense that many Jews, or at least Jews in positions of power, are putting being fashion forward ahead of fears of this creeping anti-Semitism? Are many Jews not taking this increasing anti-Semitism seriously?
I hold no brief for Mark Cuban, and I think Mark Cuban has, as a man of immense resources, has devoted almost none of them, as far as I know or can tell, to Jewish causes or causes that might help his people. So I don't know what his particular desire to be fashion forward might be. It is an unattractive quality to want to be the person who is being the paymaster for somebody like Kyrie Irving. And I do think that a lot of Jews don't want to confront the discomfort of facing down challenges that are unpleasant to them or confrontational. Some of that may be a very atavistic feeling, the Sam don't make trouble feeling. But a lot of it, I think, is wanting to look like a good progressive, and looking like a good progressive means you have no enemies on the left, and no, you know, even if they're your enemies, you won't say that. Even if they think they're your enemies, you don't act like they're your enemies.
So David Nathanson has this question, which I'm really dying to get your take on. Why no mention of the problematic humor of Dave Chappelle? I believe I'm not paranoid, but I did not laugh at a single joke that he aimed at Jews in his SNL monologue. Does this not contribute to the anti-Semitism Malcolm Gladwell suggested of the tipping point? Thoughts?
Well, I really laughed at it, and I don't think I think it is okay to poke fun at Jewish privilege and power. I don't think there's anything wrong with poking fun at it. I think what's wrong is allowing the, satirical aspects of these things to become the guiding force of them. So humor gets a lot of passes. And Chappelle, I thought, was hilarious. I understand a lot of people didn't, and that he was dancing on a line, but that's part of the stunt.
I have to say I'm on your side on this question. I laughed, and I generally think that humor deserves a lot of indulgence, because I don't know if Jews want to join the That's Not Funny coalition when it comes to all, you know, subversive humor, or humor that pokes fun at people in ways they find uncomfortable. Let me ask you, this is an interesting question from Stephanie Victor. How can you attempt to befriend a brother who shuns you? Hasidim need to open up to the rest of us. How can we penetrate that?
I'm sorry, I can't read the question because of my.
So let me reread it. It's
okay.
Hang on a second. So the question is, how can you attempt to befriend a brother who shuns you? Hasidim need to open up to the rest of us. How can we penetrate that?
No, they don't. Why do they need to open up to you? What do you need from them? Stephanie, what do you need from them? You don't need anything from them. They embarrass you or they anger you and they annoy you for reasons that are often very unclear to me. Do you feel responsible for their children's education? Do you feel responsible for their, they don't, Hasidim, first of all, we have to, there are different kinds of Hasidim. There are different kinds of Haredim. I fear that people often blend them all together. Satmar Hasidim are not the same as Lubavitch Hasidim. They have different views. They have different takes on modern life. They have different relations to Israel. Same thing with Haredi families. Why is it? I mean, Brett, you will excuse me, and I will. You will excuse me from just saying a few things about your, about the New York Times. But the New York Times sees merit and profit, in my view, in this campaign that it has been waging against Haredi education, Haredi marriages, and things like that. And I'm sure that a lot of that support or the readership that it gets, the slavish readership that it gets for these supposed exposés of horrible behavior among Haredim and Hasidim are from Jews who are looking for comfort and support for the discomfort they feel in having some connection to people who live a life in which Jewish religiosity is at the very center of their existences. They are not demanding it of you, particularly in America. If in Israel, you have a different dynamic because there are a lot of demands that Haredim are making on less religious Israelis. But here in the United States, they are making no demands on you, but somehow Jews feel as though they are somehow being made to answer for what they believe to be bad behavior. And I think this is a category error, and frankly, a kind of psychological problem among American Jews, that they look at this, small but growing group of 10, 11, 12% of the population for whom religion is the mainstay, the second by second cause and purpose of their life, and feel as though it is attacking them. What is it in our consciences? Yeah, okay.
Last question, we have 3 minutes to go. This is from Lawrence Zeifman. To what extent do you see the assault on Jews as a result of a general war on faith of the current ultra-secularized and woke culture in the U.S.? And where do you see this headed? 2 minutes.
It certainly plays a role. It plays more of a role, I think, among Jews than among non-Jews. In other words, it plays more of a role, as I just answered the previous question, among secular Jews who are made who are deeply uncomfortable and hostile to religious Jews. I don't get a sense that these distinctions are of particular moment or merit to non-Jews. Remember, the important thing to remember as we finish up here is that America is the only philo-Semitic nation on the planet Earth. Americans have a positive feeling about Jews and Jewry and about Israel. That marks this as the only country on Earth in which this is the case. This country is a blessing and a tribute. It's a blessing to us, and it is a tribute to it that we feel we Jews have been given the kinds of gifts that we have been given. And it's important to remember that, because as we look at this, one of the reasons that we can fight and win some of these battles I'm talking about is that they are anomalous. They are not left untreated. Maybe they won't be so anomalous, but if we handle them and answer them and deal with them forthrightly and not in a cowardly fashion, they can be defeated and pushed back into the dark. And that's a gift that America gives us, that you mentioned, Britain earlier. Obviously, things are going in the other direction in in France, maybe less badly in Britain than they were 7 or 8 years ago, but in France, certainly things have been heading in, you know, in a terrible opposite direction, sort of headlong back into the past. And I think we can forestall a return to the past if we act decisively.
So, John, I just want to thank you. I wish I could get to all of the questions. You wrote really a magnificent essay, not at all a surprise, coming from the editor of Commentary Magazine, the most extraordinary magazine in Jewish life since 1945, I believe, when Elliot Cohen started.
Yeah.
November of 1945, and you have kept the tradition of intellectual excellence and seriousness and deep care about Jewish life and purpose in America and the world alive. And it's lovely to be able to cross-pollinate. I've written easily a couple dozen essays for Commentary over the years, and we look forward to having Commentary editors and contributors contribute to our pages as well. I want to thank everyone for listening, and please tune in to further conversations with Sapir and some of our other authors. And thanks for creating a vibrant little Jewish culture of people who are thinking about the future in a serious and optimistic spirit, as you are, John. Have a great day.